It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Sunday, November 6th, 2022. I'm Jessica Rosenthal. Days before the election, while the Fox News power rankings show a few bright spots for Democrats, most of the shifts have been in favor of Republicans in races all across the country.
The economy, the issues of crime and, to a lesser extent, education, border security seem to be the driving force, and that's favorable to the Republicans.
I'm Jared Halpern. If Republicans win back the House, what's on the agenda for the large freshman class?
If we are going to actually encourage people to come here legally, we have to have a zero tolerance stance on illegal immigration.
This is the Fox News Rundown from Washington.
The Fox News power rankings shifted several seats this past week. In the House, 7 toss-up seats moved into lean Republican territory, like North Carolina 13, now an open seat as Republican Congressman Ted Budd runs for Senate. But it's where the Democratic candidate Wiley Nickel is facing Republican Beau Hines. Hines told the Fox News Rundown podcast last week as his district grows quickly and housing and rent prices skyrocket, the answer is to lower the prices of everything else.
But I think the best way that we do that is electing conservative leaders that we'll fight to rein in the inflation problem. We'll fight to make sure that our energy production is up here at home so that the price of goods continue to go down. And I think that's something that not only benefits my constituents here in North Carolina's 13th district, but benefits the entire country as a whole.
The rankings also had 5 lean Democrat seats shift into toss-up categories, including Virginia's 7th district, where the incumbent is Democrat Abigail Spanberger and her Republican opponent is Yesley Vega.
Members of the media ask me all the time, you talk about having solutions. How are you going to fix the economy? How are you going to fix the border crisis? How are you going to get crime down? What's your strategy? It's simple. Do the complete opposite of what Abigail Spanberger has been doing.
In Senate races, Florida Republican Marco Rubio's seat moved from lean to likely Republican, and Washington State's Senate seat moved from solid to likely Democrat, as incumbent Patty Murray faces Republican Tiffany Smiley.
I'm meeting with voters who did vote for Joe Biden and are voting for me. We're connecting on common ground. Men are saying this is the first year that my wife is not canceling my vote, and I'm honored to vote for you.
Smiley was on Fox's America's this past week. In governor's races, it's mixed. While New York's governor's race moved from likely to lean Democrat, in Oklahoma and Pennsylvania, rankings shifted toward Democrats, as they did in 6 House seats as well.
I think the fundamentals seem like they've reasserted themselves.
Chris Anderson is the president of Beacon Research. Darren Shaw is professor of government at the University of Texas in Austin, and they are both on the Fox News decision desk.
I think there's a consensus the Democrats had a good summer. It looked like they were going to minimize losses in the House, perhaps keep the Senate. I think the consensus now is that the Dobbs decision is still motivating Democrats. There's more enthusiasm than you might expect for the in party in a midterm election. But the economy, the issues of crime and, to a lesser extent, education, border security seem to be the driving force. And that's favorable to the Republicans. So I think we're back kind of where we were at the beginning of the summer in a lot of ways.
Hmm. And Chris, your thoughts, if they're different from Darren's in any ways?
Yeah, I agree that we've sort of shifted back to what you expect in a midterm, most likely. But I also do believe that there's potential that overturning of Roe did have some seismic implications that could change the makeup of the electorate. But we won't know that until election day. I'm not willing to say Dobbs is not a factor yet.
Let's drill down a little bit. Look at the Senate first. Chris, the toss-ups haven't changed much, right? It's Arizona, Georgia, Nevada, and Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is Republican held. Arizona, Nevada, and Georgia are held by Democrats. But where do we see the biggest possibility, if we had to guess, of a party flip?
I'd say Pennsylvania for Fetterman. We just finished a poll there. We have the race at Fetterman 45, Oz 42. So I think that Fetterman has a pretty good chance of holding on there. There's a candidate issue there where even those who say they are voting for Oz are not enthusiastic about it. They're 20 points less likely to be enthusiastic than Fetterman voters. So I see Pennsylvania as the Democrats' best chance for a pickup.
Let's look at some of the lean races, like where we see the possibility for the most surprise. Darren, the lean Republicans that we have in our power rankings are Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson. He's the incumbent there. And Ohio, J.D. Vance and Tim Ryan. That's currently Republican held. North Carolina is Ted Budd versus Sherry Beasley. That's also a Republican held seat. Where might we see a surprise if we see one at all in these leans?
Ooh, it's a good question. You know, I sort of expected Johnston to build on a lead that he held in late September. As we said, the general pattern is that over the course of October, you've seen Republicans pick up a couple of points, not five or six, but a couple. And I figured that Johnson would benefit from that, and he'd be up, you know, 4, 5, 6 points right now. I don't think that's where that race is right now. I think it's still a 1 or 2 point race, and that surprises me a little bit. He's got some real negatives. You know, he's been around a while. You know, the North Carolina, that always seems fool's gold for the Democrats. I mean, at some point it might not be, but they always get close and don't quite get across the line. Ohio, I think they've got the best candidate of the batch. And I might even go to the toss-up states right now. I think most of us have been really impressed with Ryan and think that, boy, if Ryan were to pull an upset, that we're talking not just about Ohio, but national implications for that. But I'd still probably go with Wisconsin is the best chance for a Democratic shocker.
Hmm. Okay, Darren, I'm going to stick with you for this question also, because let's look at the leans on the Democrat side. Colorado, where Senator Bennett is the incumbent, could Joe O'Dea win there, or could General Bolduc win in New Hampshire against Senator Maggie Hassan?
Yeah, these are two fascinating races. I throw Washington State into that as well. So I'll give you Colorado, New Hampshire, and Washington as chances for Republican shockers. The thing that's interesting across those three states is that O'Day and I think Smiley in O'Day in Colorado and Smiley in Washington State are considered really good candidates. Mm-hmm. And O'Day has, to Chris's point earlier about the Dobbs decision, O'Day has worked assiduously to kind of neutralize that issue in Colorado. And he's, you know, the Democratic and Democratic affiliates keep pounding him on it. But I've talked with a lot of Coloradans, and their sense is that that's not really cutting terribly well there. I still think, you know, Bennett's the favorite. The exception here, and the one that I'd be most surprised, is Bolduc in New Hampshire, who's actually doing better in the polling than the other two.
Yeah.
But seems to have the most baggage as a candidate. Now, New Hampshire's a quirky state. Chris can tell you about that. He does a lot of work in the New England area. But I don't know if it's quirky enough, even though he's getting also a heavy lift from Sununu. I don't know if it's enough to get him across the line. I guess of the three, I'd probably go New Hampshire, but okay. I don't know why I'm picking the race with kind of objectively the weakest of the three Republican candidates.
Well, and you know, to that point, actually, Chris, this is my next question. If Bolduc wins, is that a wake-up call to the Democrat strategy to spend money to boost up the more Trumpy candidate? Or do they look at, you know, Doug Mastriano in Pennsylvania, John Gibbs in Michigan 3, Dan Cox in the GOP governor's race in Maryland, and say, well, for the most part, it worked?
No, that's a great question. You know, it's obviously a very risky strategy for the Democrats. But I think that, you know, if Bolduc were to win in New Hampshire, it probably means that Republicans are winning in other close races as well. Because the way these things typically go is when you know, we're looking at a lot of close races right now, a lot of races where nobody's over 50. Usually, you know, even if it's not a wave, the majority tend to break one way or the other. So I think if Republicans pick up New Hampshire, it probably means that they're picking up the majority of these other close races also. In which case, yes, then I think the Democrats are thinking that strategy of boosting Trump-backed candidates didn't work.
Let's break down some of the power rankings in the House. We've had a lot of shakeups now. We've had some seats that we thought were toss-ups. Now they're lean Republican. Let's go through them. California 27, that's North Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. I know that area well. Oregon 5 touches the Portland suburbs. New York 19 is known as a swing district, maybe New York's only swing district. I think so is Virginia 2. That's a known swing. Colorado 8 is a brand new seat, and it's got some Denver suburbs in there. North Carolina 13 now has a part of Raleigh in there. Darren, you know I'm coming to you for this because we've talked about this before. Is this a story about the burbs?
It's I was going to say, geez, there seems to be a common denominator. All we were talking with our the brain room here at Fox recently about some of these ratings, and it was almost like, well, is it a newish district with a suburban constituency? Yeah, well, why don't we just put it in the toss up? this is interesting because the Dobbs decision, the narrative is the Dobbs decision disproportionately affected suburban women, and that, you know, this has been a buzzword and a, you know, political marketing, you know, boon for the past 10 years. Like, you know, everybody's got a name for it, right? It used to be soccer moms, and then it was waitress moms, and you know, whatever marketing nomenclature you can use to pretend that you have the keys to understanding this key constituency. And you did see some movement towards the Democrats in the late summer and early fall, not amongst this group and then attendantly within those districts. Again, you know, if we're going to be cliched here and speak in generalities, suburban women are also really concerned about rising prices and education issues. Mm-hmm. And I think there's just a tension there. To be clear, white suburban women are a key, sort of swing constituency. But women in the suburbs are not as monochromatic as is sometimes assumed, right? There's an assumption that if you're talking about suburban women, you're talking about white suburban women. That's not true anymore. There are, you know, appreciable Latino and African-American populations in the suburbs and lots of females, you know, female African-Americans, female Hispanic voters. And they're the ones who have really kind of moved the dial to the left. The white suburban women are conflicted. I think you still see this playing out. That's why those races are up for grabs, and I'm not sure it's consistent polling data to suggest what the key to their hearts is.
I should interview myself as a suburban mother. let's dive into some of the races that were lean Democrat and are now toss-ups. Chris, I'm coming to you. California 47, that's Congresswoman Katie Porter's seat. New York 4, the open seat. Virginia 7, Democratic Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger's seat. Washington 8, Kim Schreier's seat. And Connecticut 5, Johanna Hayes is facing George Logan there. Lot of incumbent Democratic women in what we think of as being, for the most part, pretty blue states. I think I can say that with California and Connecticut, New York, even Washington State. Is this also a story about the suburbs, Chris?
It certainly could be. I think that in those districts specifically, and probably in the ones that Darren was just talking about as well, I think sometimes we get caught into this mindset of what is the single biggest issue. Mm-hmm. But I think for a lot of voters, especially probably a lot of, suburban moms, they're going to be weighing and holding two very important things in their mind, which is, the economy and reproductive freedom. And I think that we should realize that voters are capable of holding more than one issue and weighing more than one issue at once.
Democrats do have some bright spots as we talk about all this. There are five races now in the lean Democrat category. Alaska's at large seat with Mary Peltola and Sarah Palin there. New Hampshire 1, Pappas is the incumbent. Arizona 4, Greg Stanton is the Democratic incumbent. Kansas 3, Cherise Davids. Pennsylvania 17, that's Connor Lamb's old seat, now open. And Nebraska 2 has become lean Republican rather than likely. That's Don Bacon's seat. We know that's a very tight district historically anyway. What can we say about Democrats maybe doing well in certain areas? Chris?
Sure. Yeah, and this is, I think, an important thing to keep in mind is that there's very different dynamics in different districts. And again, coming back to the road decision, I'll be surprised if we don't look back and say, this handful of districts landed in the Republican column because of Roe. So we'll see. But I think that I will be very surprised if that doesn't serve, if not at the very least, as sort of a backstop for Democrats in some districts, and probably as wind in the sails in some districts that may have been more conservative in the past.
Yeah, Chris, to that point, has that been the Roe decision, the abortion discussion, does it depend on where you are? Because we've heard a lot of candidates say, especially Republicans, they've said, look, abortion is not an issue here. It's a state's issue, and this state protects abortion, so it's off the table. If it's not off the table, or it was getting a lot of discussion in certain areas, are the stakes different for different areas depending on that?
Oh, I think so. I think absolutely that's the case. You know, we can go back to the special election in Kansas, which I'm losing track of how long ago that was.
Yeah, over the summer.
just this summer, where we saw that really surprising result. Clearly, a mobilization of women, especially who had not been especially active in the past politically, that came out and voted in, you know, traditionally red Kansas. So it could be that the stakes are even higher in the areas where Republicans have been in control or favored in the past.
All right, finally, gentlemen, governor's races. We got to hit those before we go. The toss-ups are still Arizona, Wisconsin, Nevada, Oregon, Kansas, and New Mexico. All of these but Arizona are held by Democrats, if I'm correct. The West Coast part of me is paying attention to Oregon, but where do we think a flip is most likely here? Both of you, Darren, let's go to you first.
Oh man, you stole my thunder. It's Oregon. Anybody who's been to Portland in the last 4 or 5 years doesn't need to be reminded about why a Republican gubernatorial candidate is doing well in that state. So I'll go Oregon. On the outside, that New Mexico race is interesting. I mentioned fool's gold in North Carolina for the Republicans. New Mexico's always been a little bit of fool's gold for the New North Carolina for the Democrats, and New Mexico tends to be fool's gold for the Republicans. But I think that race is moving a little bit. So that's my sleeper race. But yeah, Oregon's the one where I think there's the highest level of probability Republicans pick up.
And Chris?
Yeah, I think that Kari Lake in Arizona has tapped into something that could get her over the line there. It would be really interesting to see if there or in Wisconsin we have a split ticket where, you know, one party wins the Senate, the other wins the governor's race.
All right, Darren Shaw, Chris Anderson, thank you guys both so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
I'm Guy Benson. Join me weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and guests. Listen live on the Fox News app or get the free podcast at GuyBensonShow.com.
If Republicans win control of the House on Tuesday, it will be by flipping Biden 1 congressional districts. Those potential majority-making Republican lawmakers could represent a new generation for the GOP, younger, more diverse, and more female than the current makeup of the conference. One of those potential majority makers is Ana Paulina Luna. The 33-year-old is looking to win Florida's 13th district, making up the area around St. Petersburg. The seat was vacated earlier this year by Democrat Charlie Crist, who is now running for governor. 2 years ago, President Biden won the 13th by about 4 points, but redistricting in a favorable environment for Republicans has made Luna a clear favorite for the seat. The Fox News Power Rankings rate that district as a likely Republican district. So in our final From Washington before the midterms, I'm joined by Florida Republican candidate Ana Paulina Luna for a chat about her views on a Republican-led House, the issues she wants to focus on, and if there's common ground in a divided government.
You know, initially, I was actually on track to go to medical school, and then during my gap year, I had gotten involved with a counter-trafficking organization that was largely focused on combating child trafficking at the U.S.-Mexico border. And I realized at that point in time that here I was, you know, a United States Air Force veteran. I'm half Mexican, second generation American. And yet I agreed with, at the time, candidate Trump's platform on immigration and border security. And this was before he was elected in 2016. And I realized that the more I talked about it, the more that people actually pushed back that were uneducated on the topic. And so I started using my platform in an effort to educate people, and I realized that it would be through my work as a legislator that I would be able to help kind of direct national discussion in regards to problem solving. And so a lot of people will try to make the border security issue partisan, and it shouldn't be. It's absolutely a humanitarian crisis, and we have to have a zero tolerance on it. So it really started there and kind of progressed into me weighing in on other issues as well. But I am very excited because I bring a unique lens and perspective, especially on those topics.
Well, let me talk about border security, because I know you've made that a big part of your campaign. Do you see a path forward? Listen, if Republicans win back the House, there's still a Democratic president. It is unlikely that either Republicans or Democrats would have sort of that 60 vote sort of supermajority in the Senate, right? So a path to any sort of immigration or border bill would require some level of, I guess, compromise. How do you sort of view that debate moving forward in Congress over the next couple of years?
Well, the fact is that what's happening at our border is not just a humanitarian crisis, but it's a national security crisis as well. Mm-hmm. And so I think one of the biggest things that we need to be focusing on is, A, we need to make sure that the American people know the truth. If, you know, people are educated on what's really happening, I believe that that public pressure will put a lot of pressure on their representatives to do the right thing. But also to, you know, a lot of people aren't talking about the fact that, you know, the people that are coming into this country that are unvetted and unchecked, a lot of them aren't necessarily here just to work. Some of them are here to do bad things. And the fact is we've caught many people on the top 10 most wanted terrorist watch list actually trying to infiltrate our country through the southern border. And so these are all things that I think that we need to continue to not just educate, but also to tell the American people. And then it is my hope that once we do take back Congress and Senate, that through working together, that we'll actually be able to secure that.
Would you be receptive? Do you agree with some of these previous proposals that have come forward that include, you know, beefing up the security aspect at the border, whether that's through infrastructure, whether it's through, you know, the technology, coupling that with some sort of, you know, visa reform, DACA? What do you think about the pathways to legal status for those who are brought here at a young age, sometimes, you know, unbeknownst to them?
You know, I don't think that we need to. I think that we, first of all, we have to end DACA. DACA, in my opinion, was created by the Obama administration as something that they would use long term in an effort to really shift voting towards the Democrat Party platform. The fact is that we have to have a zero tolerance stance on illegal immigration. I would not be in favor of giving citizenship to DACA recipients. First step is those we have to end the program altogether. We do need, yes, to have more technology and also physical barriers. I've been down to the border 3 times, but I think more importantly, you know, we can't even have legal immigration in this country done correctly because the immigration system as a whole is so bogged down by those coming here illegally. And so if we are going to actually encourage people to come here legally, we have to have a zero tolerance stance on illegal immigration. So I think that this is definitely going to be a very, very long discussion, something that is way overdue and something that we need to have. But also in addition to that, I think the fact is that there's a lot of people that want to come here to work. And fact is that our visa system currently should be a biometric enrollment. And it's something that we are kind of out of date with. So there's a lot to discuss and to go in, I think, further in depth on.
A lot of funding.
Yes, a lot of funding. But again, it's a national security issue, right? If we don't have our border in check, it's going to impact the rest of the country, not just with drugs and fentanyl, but then also this aspect of modern day slavery.
It's expected that early next year, Congress is probably going to get asked to have a vote on raising the debt ceiling, the debt limit. Republicans, as you know, increasingly reluctant to do that. Curious how you view that upcoming debate.
We have to balance the budget. I'm not in favor of raising the debt ceiling. In fact, I would be in favor of ensuring that we go to a standstill until we can discuss that. The fact is that this country right now is economically crippled. There's a lot of people that are afraid of even saying that because they don't want to get pushed back. But the fact is that, you know, it's my generation, it's future generations that are paying for it. And I just don't see an end in sight if we don't stop it right now.
Does that include then sort of spending cuts if
yes,
there were
absolutely.
Some sort of move? Where would you start with that? Is it?
I'd have to say right now, one of the areas that we could do without sending more money to is the IRS. And so I think that when you look at the commitment to America that the Republican Party just relaunched, that's one of the first things that we're going to be discussing. But, you know, when you're looking at what the proposals were of the Biden administration and what they're proposing now versus, you know, where they're cutting from, the fact is that our military military and a lot of our securities here in the country are actually receiving cuts. And then they're beefing up places like education. You know, by 2027, China is hoping to become military, from a military perspective, more superior than the United States. We are about 10 aircraft carriers behind in that regard. And by 2030, China is trying to become a world superpower. And so it's in my opinion that instead of giving more funding to these programs, a lot of which it seems the Biden administration has been focusing on the woke agenda, that we should be, one, rebalancing, and then also, two, cutting a lot of spending from these programs that simply don't need it. If I can add one more thing, too. Yeah. Remember, the PAC Act is something that Senate just passed, right? Mm-hmm. It had $400 billion that didn't even go to veterans. It went to pet projects having nothing to do with the burn pits. So that, as a veteran, I see that as not only unnecessary spending on behalf of the American people, but also too, they used veterans in order to gaslight Americans, which is completely unacceptable.
I'm sure you have heard President Biden say that if Republicans win back the House, they are going to cut Social Security and cut Medicare. Do you plan to do that? What is your response to those accusations?
You know, Biden has said a lot of things that are untrue about the Republican Party. That would be one of them. The fact is that right now, unfortunately, this administration has been, and largely for the last 2 years, using fear mongering against the American people. So if you look again at the commitment to America that the GOP just launched, that's not on the top tier. Although I will say, you know, as someone who likely will not have access to Social Security, I think that Americans should have an option to opt out.
Opt out of Social Security.
Correct.
So you wouldn't pay into it, and the cross, I guess, then you wouldn't accept it, right? You wouldn't pay into it, you wouldn't get it.
Correct.
Okay. And so that's legislation you'd be interested in pursuing.
I would have to look at how that impacts. Yeah. But yeah, I think that that's something that we need to discuss. You know, again, going back to the whole issue of illegal immigration, a lot of these taxpayer-funded programs are now fair game for some of these states that are sanctuary mm-hmm. cities, sanctuary states. And so, again, going back to how it's really impacting and affecting all of us, the fact is that, you know, for example, take Florida, for example, my community in Florida 13, we have a large amount of people that are on fixed income and solely rely on Social Security. And so how is it fair to these people that have paid in their entire life into the system, and yet they're essentially giving it away in places like California?
I know you bring, if you are elected, you will bring to Congress, you know, national security experience serving in the Air Force. Where does that orient you at all on the question of Ukraine aid and sort of how long and how sustainable the U.S. commitment, and pretty bipartisan at this point, commitment has been to Ukraine?
You know, the fact is that Ukraine did not want to join NATO, right? And we have gone above and beyond. We've sent them plenty of munitions. We've sent them plenty of ordnance. However, at a certain point, we have to remember that here in the United States, people are struggling. I can tell you that here in Pinellas County, a lot of people are being priced out because of what we're seeing with the current inflation issue. And then also, too, this country is facing a diesel crisis that is going to be hitting everyone. That is going to directly impact food and everything in between. And so the fact is that I am for supporting our allies. However, there has to be a certain limit, and I believe that we've hit that limit.
So probably no more you would support in Ukraine assistance.
Correct. In fact, I can tell you that one of the most recent bills that we've sent that actually sent money there went to funding their government. You know, mm-hmm. At a certain point, we have to remember that we have issues. We have very big issues here at home. And the fact is that while this has been happening, China is basically working with Russia and Iran. We have the highest inflation we've seen in a long time. We are facing a diesel crisis. Our strategic oil reserves are essentially depleted. And we have someone in the White House that on the world stage is not being respected by very bad people. And so we have to take a hardline stance against that. And I look forward to, you know, not just going up there to cause a ruckus, but going up there to bring common sense back to Washington, D.C. and to really represent common people, the people that, you know, I basically am a part of.
Do you see a much of an appetite or an environment as it relates to sort of common ground, bipartisanship? I guess I'm thinking specifically, you know, we had in the last year the bipartisan infrastructure law. There was that CHIPS bill that dealt with semiconductor funding. Are those pieces of legislation that you would have supported or had concerns about?
You know, I think the infrastructure bill would be something that I would have had some concern on. I would have to, again, go back and reference some more of those. Yeah. But I am looking forward to, and I think that...
I realize you weren't there. I don't mean to put you in the spot.
No, you're fine. You're fine. And I'll be the first person to admit, you know, if I have to look into something further. But I think that I can actually probably get a lot of bipartisan support on the privacy issues that we're seeing with big tech, right? So we know from the conservative standpoint and platform that many conservatives have been largely censored and suppressed on social media. Ronna McDaniel over at the GOP basically said that they caught Google sending a ton of the RNC's information emails all to, you know, spam folders or not even sending at all. But the fact is that here in the United States, we have something that most other countries don't have, and that's the right to privacy. However, it seems that big tech and their cartels are exploiting it. So that's something that I hope to get bipartisan support on, and I think that we'll find it.
How much of the agenda, as you see it, is that legislative side versus some of the oversight or hearing side? I mean, do you anticipate voting to, like, impeach members of the administration?
You know, I'm going to have to get there first, but what I can tell you is there's a lot on oversight that we need to get done. I can tell you that here in our community that we were directly impacted by the, you know, botched withdrawal in Afghanistan, we have questions. Mm-hmm. And I think the American people, service members, have questions on what happened, especially with the failed leadership that we saw out of the Biden administration in that regard. So I think it's probably going to be about a 50-50 split. I can tell you that right now there's a lot of people that you probably would never expect to be voting in a midterm that they're voting because they're being impacted by the economy. But even more so, a lot of people have really lost faith in our electoral process, and that's dangerous. And so we need to ensure that people not only have confidence and that they don't feel that there's a gross double standard that exists within the FBI and the DOJ, but also, too, that we are restoring faith with them for future generations.
Let me finish with this question, because one of the first decisions members of Congress have to make is a vote for Speaker of the House. Is it your plan to support Kevin McCarthy in that?
Yeah, Kevin McCarthy is going to be, I believe right now what we've heard is that he's going to be the only one running for speaker. And so we look forward to bringing home those commitments to America, something that Leader McCarthy has really worked on with Speaker Newt Gingrich. And I also plan on joining the House Freedom Caucus. So I'm very excited about the 118th Congress.
Any other committees you're hoping to join?
First one would be Veteran Affairs. I have one of the biggest veteran populations in the country here in Pinellas County. Sure. And then the second would be Oversight. And as you said, we have questions. And so I look forward to being alongside AOC, because it appears that she's on Oversight as well.
Appreciate you taking the time. I know it is busy for you. You have a couple more days here left in the campaign. My best to you as you move forward here over the next couple of days.
Thank you very much. God bless.
That will do it for this week's Fox News Rundown from Washington. Next week, our first post-midterm show of 2022. We will have so much to dive into, from the results to the reactions on both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue and beyond. But before then, I invite you to join us on election night. Jessica Rosenthal and I will host Fox News Radio's election night coverage Tuesday, November 8th, beginning at 6 p.m. Eastern Time across the Fox News Radio network in the Fox News app. Until then, from all of us at Fox News Radio, thank you so much for listening. I'm Jared Halpern from Washington. Please rate and review this podcast at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts. Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts, and Amazon Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app.
The Will Cain Show is now dropping 5 episodes a week. Join Fox and Friends weekend host Will Cain as he tackles the latest headlines from his unique perspective, along with thought-provoking interviews with leading figures and live calls from viewers and listeners. Listen wherever you download your favorite podcasts.